at amos.indiana.edu. To get podcasts, click on the podcast button. For a Moment of Science, I'm Don Glass.
In sports, another round of Major League Baseball's interleague play is underway. This afternoon in Chicago, the Cubs are entertaining the Minnesota Twins. In the bottom of the fourth, the Twins lead the Cubs 4-0. The St. Louis Cardinals will go after their third consecutive win tonight when they take on Cleveland at Progressive Field. The victories allowed a season-high five-game losing streak, during which St. Louis was outscored 37-12 while batting .209. The Chicago White Sox are in Milwaukee to face the Brewers tonight for the first game of a three-game series. Milwaukee and Chicago met for four straight years in interleague play after the Brewers moved to the NL in 1998, but they haven't played since 2001. The Los Angeles Lakers can wrap up their 15th NBA title with a victory in Orlando on Sunday. The Western Conference champions got 32 points from Kobe Bryant and beat the Magic 99-91 in overtime to grab a commanding 3-1 lead in the best-of-seven championship series. And Detroit is humming ahead of tonight's Stanley Cup Finals finale. The defending champion Red Wings are getting set to host the decisive game in their best-of-seven showdown for the championship with the Pittsburgh Penguins. That's sports.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to experience the three-play summer studio series this June and July. More information is at KrannertCenter.com.
It's 2:42. President Obama's special Middle East envoy has a new stop on his tour of the region, Damascus, Syria. George Mitchell is expected in the Syrian capital today. Now, relations between the United States and Syria have been sour since the early days of the Bush administration. A glance at a map gives you some idea why. Syria sits between two troubled countries, Lebanon on one side, Iraq on the other. And the United States in recent years accused Syria of meddling in Lebanon as well as allowing insurgents into Iraq. The Obama administration has made it clear that it wants a fresh start. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Damascus.
The Obama administration signaled early it wanted better relations with Syria. The Treasury Department approved the sale of American-made spare parts to Syrian airlines despite U.S. sanctions. The Syrian ambassador in Washington was invited to the State Department for the first time in years. The arrival here of Mr. Obama's special Middle East envoy and a high-level delegation from U.S. Central Command signals a fresh start, says Assistant Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad.
We have always advocated a process of dialogue between Syria and the United States, and this is the beginning, and we hope that the beginning is going to be a successful one.
Official confirmation of Mitchell's trip was delayed until after the Lebanese elections. Washington backed the winners, the pro-Western bloc. Syria publicly accepted the democratic defeat of its allies, a coalition led by Hezbollah. But Syria's influence in Lebanon is likely on Mitchell's agenda. His visit comes after the president's landmark speech in Cairo, calling for comprehensive peace in the region. Syrians note that Mr. Obama did not mention what they care about most, the Golan Heights, Syrian land occupied by Israel since 1967, says Miqdad.
I don't think that President Obama has tackled all these issues in his speech. What Senator Mitchell is coming to discuss is what President Obama has mentioned and what he did not mention.
Syria has a long agenda, following Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's recent pledge to work towards a thaw in strained relations. For Syria, that means lifting U.S. sanctions, returning an ambassador to Damascus, and getting the Syrian-Israeli peace talks back on track. But there is still distrust.
Well, this is, I think, the fear on the part of the Syrians, is that America wants to cherry pick.
That's American Professor Josh Landis, a Syrian expert currently visiting Damascus. He says Syria wants a discussion that goes beyond Lebanon and security in Iraq.
They want the complete package so that they don't move forward on the things that are meaningful to America without getting things that are meaningful to Syria.
The Mitchell visit will test the distance between Damascus and Washington. Syria supports Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas in Gaza, and has a strong alliance with Iran. Former President Jimmy Carter, also visiting Damascus, says that Syria's alliances shouldn't stand in the way.
Well, I think Syria's intentions are to have good relationships with the United States, to continue to have contact with Hamas and Hezbollah, to still have friendly relationships with Iran. But there's no reason why Syria shouldn't have friendly relationships with both, say, Iran and with the United States.
Carter said that President Obama wants good relations, could lift sanctions, and will respond to any positive sign. Deborah Amos, NPR News, Damascus.
Coming up today on The World from PRI, Iranian democracy gets an online boost from Iranian students here in the United States. They're using a social networking strategy they learned from the Obama campaign. They're not endorsing a candidate, but they are helping to get voters to the polls. That story and an election update from Tehran next time on The World. The program gets underway at 3 o'clock. Central Time. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for public telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of University of Illinois alumni Alice and Robert Campbell. And we thank the 111 of you who called or logged on and pledged more than $12,000 to WILL Radio during yesterday's one-day fundraising event. Your contributions will help us continue to serve you well in the coming year. If you didn't get a chance to make a pledge yesterday, you can log on to willpledge.org anytime. And thank you for making a difference. It's 2:47. 1 year ago this week, the Cedar River in Iowa crested almost 20 feet above flood level. That was more than 11 feet higher than the previous record flood. Heavy winter storms and an exceptionally wet spring, capped by torrential thunderstorms, swelled the river as wide as the Mississippi. 10 square miles of Cedar Rapids were underwater. NPR's David Schaefer reported on the flood last June. He returned to see how the city is doing 1 year later.
Anyone wanting to check out a book from the Cedar Rapids Public Library now has to go to the mall. 1 year ago, the Cedar River flooded like never before, and the library in downtown Cedar Rapids was one of thousands of buildings inundated.
This was an Esco drugstore.
Tamara Gleiss, interim director of the Cedar Rapids Public Library, says the struggling Westdale Mall, far from downtown, had several empty spaces and required creative adaptations.
We actually opened up what used to be a storage room in the old drugstore and turned that into the adult stacks.
The library isn't alone at the mall. The county government relocated its offices there, too, because of the flood, after the Cedar River crested last June 13th, almost 20 feet above flood level and more than 11 feet higher than the previous record flood. Heavy winter snows and an exceptionally wet spring capped by torrential thunderstorms swelled the Cedar River as wide as the Mississippi, leaving 10 square miles of Cedar Rapids underwater, including 1,000 businesses and more than 5,000 homes, along with City Hall and most other vital government buildings.
We had 8 foot of water in the building, so the tip of my finger.
6'3" Al Pearson stretches up to show how high the water rose in his flower shop in the northwest section of Cedar Rapids. This is a mostly working-class neighborhood across the river from downtown, full of small, older, 1 and 1.5-story frame houses, many of which are now boarded up or hollowed out. This and the adjacent Czech Village neighborhood to the south were the hardest hit by the floodwaters, and Pearson's flower shop and greenhouses got hammered.
So we lost everything out here.
Al Pearson takes us out to a courtyard filled with flowers and potted plants, and then through his long, narrow greenhouses.
This got pushed in by the surge of water. It was pushed in. This big palm tree went through the flood. It survived. It was knocked over. Everything in here looked like a bomb went off.
Pearson says that includes the adjacent house his grandparents built and the one next door that he grew up in. He says this family flower business that his grandparents started 80 years ago suffered $1 million in damages, and Pearson didn't have insurance.
What went through my mind was, I'm done, I'm finished, I'm out of business, I'm done.
But Pearson eventually decided to clean up, repair, and try to reopen. He became frustrated trying to obtain government assistance, but with a loan from the local credit union, the flower shop was able to reopen last November. What Pearson lacks now is many of his neighbors and customers. Few displaced residents of Cedar Rapids have been able to repair or rebuild their homes.
It's sad. It's sad because I know all these people. I know their names. A lot of them are houses that have been handed down to their kids, or their kids bought from their parents. So I knew the parents. I know the kids, and you know, it's sad.
I'm standing in the middle of 6th Street Northwest. Almost every home up and down this street looks like it's been completely abandoned. Many have signs saying that they are structurally unsound, unsafe to enter, and many look like they haven't been entered since the floodwaters raged through here a year ago. But there is some home rebuilding underway in Cedar Rapids, sometimes just one or two homes on a block, but sometimes more. And much of the work is being done by volunteers. The few residents who can't afford it are renovating their homes themselves, but the vast majority of the homes damaged and destroyed in Cedar Rapids were small, valued at $50,000 to $80,000 and occupied by lower-income homeowners or renters. Few had flood insurance, and those turning to the government for assistance are finding it difficult.
For one flood survivor who is trying to rebuild their house, they have to go through 9 different steps with the federal government in order to get payment.
Lou Barron chairs the Linn County, Iowa Board of Supervisors.
That is very cumbersome. It's very discouraging, and it makes recovery so slow.
Those who don't want to rebuild or can't are waiting for possible government buyouts, but many have run out of emergency government aid. Hundreds remain in FEMA trailers. Others struggle to pay for both rental housing and the mortgage on a flood-damaged home. Housing and Urban Development Secretary Sean Donovan in Cedar Rapids this week promised the Obama administration will work to streamline the bureaucratic process. He also brought $500 million in new federal flood recovery funds for Iowa, some of which will go toward the long-awaited buyouts. But local officials say much more federal funding is needed, and it may take 10 years or more for Cedar Rapids to fully recover. David Schaefer, NPR News.
David Schaefer will have more on Cedar Rapids' recovery efforts later this afternoon on All Things Considered. In California, J. Fitzgerald grows 190 different kinds of stone fruit. NPR's Ina Jaffe visited him at his stand at the sprawling farmers market in Santa Monica.
Maybe a rose is a rose is a rose, but at Fitzgerald Kelly's fruit stand, a nectarine may be a lovely Lolita, or a peach, a virgin blush. Or
this is a combination of plum and apricot.
Kelly holds up a Flavorella Aprium. It's 1/4 plum and 3/4 apricot and about the size of a ping pong ball.
But the flavor range within this piece of fruit is phenomenal because when you first bite into it, it has a texture of, is it plum or is it apricot? And then the finish is something from citrus, like a lime.
Kelly must really like this Aprium because it's a pain in the neck to grow.
You know, we have 25 trees. I don't know, we get 10 pieces of fruit per tree. It's the dumbest thing in the world to grow. But by God, the fruit is good.
And he's eternally optimistic.
So I'm thinking that one year I'm actually going to get a lot of fruit. You know, next year is always going to be better.
Kelly grows 190 varieties of tree fruit, not all in season at the same time, of course. Right now, he's got another plum and apricot mix, the Pluot. 3/4 plum, 1/4 apricot. This variety is called the Flavorosa.
And it, to all appearances, it looks like a kind of a dark, very nearly black purple plum.
With a deep garnet flesh.
They are not as complicated a flavor as the Flavorella Aprium, but they're distinctive. They are not a plum.
He's also particularly proud of some little apricots he's named Elgin Marbles. Customer Judy Haft likes them, too.
These are the best-tasting apricots in the market.
Yeah, these are special. I'm the only one who grows these.
Kelly's been raising new varieties of stone fruit developed by professional plant breeders for a long time. Now he's starting to invent some of his own. For example, a plum and white nectarine mix that he respectfully calls Mr. McNulty.
And it is ugly. Let's say, right off, it is kind of a mauve colored with speckles, but it eats spectacularly.
So he's going to sell it. Look for Mr. McNulty at Kelly's Fruit Stand at the end of June. Ina Jaffe, NPR News.
There's more about J. Fitzgerald Kelly and his stone fruit at NPR's website, www.npr.org. It's 5 minutes before 3 o'clock. The forecast for Illinois and Indiana, prepared by meteorologist Daniel Pounder this afternoon, partly sunny and cool. Highs ranging from 68 near the Chicago lakefront to 81 in the far south. Tonight in Illinois, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and isolated thunderstorms, especially late. In Indiana tonight, mostly cloudy. Lows ranging from 53 in the north to 65 in the south. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with scattered showers and a few isolated thunderstorms, highs ranging from 68 near the Chicago lakefront to 85 in the south. In Champaign-Urbana this afternoon, partly sunny, the high 77, the wind light out of the northeast. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a slight chance of overnight showers, the low 58, the wind light out of the northeast. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a chance of showers during the morning, the high near 80, the wind from the northeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. The outlook for tomorrow night, mostly cloudy, the low 60, Sunday, partly sunny, the high 78. Sunday night, mostly cloudy, the low 62. And the outlook for Monday, mostly cloudy, the high 82. It is 75 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois.
Earth and Sky.
Friday, June 12, 2009. It's easy to see the planet Jupiter right now, but to do it, you have to stay up late or wake up early.
This planet is up over the horizon in the hours after midnight. It shines highest in the sky at or before morning dawn. On Saturday and Sunday mornings, you can see Jupiter, a blazing point of light, near the waning gibbous moon in the pre-dawn sky. Jupiter is the third brightest heavenly body in the sky, after the moon and Venus. So you can't miss it right now, next to the moon, in the hours between midnight and dawn, in the next couple of mornings.
As the largest world in our solar system, Jupiter's volume exceeds that of Earth by over 1,000 times. The king of planets also has the greatest number of known moons, 63 so far.
The four largest moons are Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto. These moons orbit more or less above Jupiter's equator, and their orbital plane is edgewise to the Earth and Sun this year. That means that Jupiter's moons are eclipsing each other over and over throughout 2009, as seen from Earth's vantage point. You need a telescope to see the eclipses of Jupiter's moons.
But if it's clear this weekend, you can't miss Jupiter with